this principle with this direction. Relax, look around, make a call. Even the most competent of leaders can be overwhelmed if they try to tackle multiple problems or a number of tasks simultaneously. The team will likely fail at each of those tasks. Instead, leaders must determine the highest priority task and execute. When overwhelmed, fall back upon this principle: prioritize and execute. Multiple problems in high-pressure, high-stakes environments are not exclusive to combat. They occur in many facets of life, and particularly in business. Business decisions may lack the immediacy of life and death, but the pressures on business leaders are still intense. The success or failure of the team, the department, the company, the financial capital of investors, careers, and livelihoods are at stake. These pressures produce stress and demand decisions that often require rapid execution. Such decision-making for leaders can be overwhelming. A particularly effective means to help prioritize and execute under pressure is to stay at least a step or two ahead of real-time problems. Through careful contingency planning, a leader can anticipate likely challenges that could arise during execution and map out an effective response to those challenges before they happen. That leader and his or her team are far more likely to win. Staying ahead of the curve prevents a leader from being overwhelmed when pressure is applied and enables greater decisiveness. If the team has been briefed and understands what actions to take through such lengthy contingencies, the team can then rapidly execute when those problems arise, even without specific direction from leaders. This is a critical characteristic of any high-performance winning team in any business or industry. It also enables effective, decentralized command. When confronted with the enormity of operational plans and the intricate micro-terrain within those plans, it becomes easy to get lost in the details, to become sidetracked, or lose focus on the bigger effort. It is crucial, particularly for leaders at the top of the organization, to pull themselves off the firing line, step back, and maintain the strategic picture. This is essential to help correctly prioritize for the team. With this perspective, it becomes far easier to determine the highest priority effort and focus all energies toward its execution. Then, senior leaders must help subordinate team leaders within their team prioritize their efforts. Just as in combat, priorities can rapidly shift and change. When this happens, communication of that shift to the rest of the team, both up and down the chain of command, is critical. Teams must be careful to avoid target fixation on a single issue. They cannot fail to recognize when the highest priority task shifts to something else. The team must maintain the ability to quickly reprioritize efforts and rapidly adapt to a constantly changing battlefield. To implement prioritize and execute in any business, team, or organization, a leader must do the following. Evaluate the highest priority problem. Lay out in simple, clear, and concise terms the highest priority effort for your team. Develop and determine a solution. Seek input from key leaders and from the team where possible. Direct the execution of that solution, focusing all efforts and resources toward this priority task. Move on to the next highest priority problem. Repeat. When priorities shift within the team, pass situational awareness both up and down the chain of command. Don't let the focus on one priority cause target fixation. Maintain the ability to see other problems developing and rapidly shift as needed.
Application to business. Jocko Willink. There was only one major problem. The company was losing money. Through years as a profitable player in the pharmaceutical industry, the company experienced several phases of expansion. All seemed well, but recently, revenues had taken a slight downward trend. At first, that trend could be blamed on market conditions or seasonal discrepancies. But when the downward trend continued, it was clear that the lower revenues had metastasized from temporary setback to the new reality. The CEO of this pharmaceutical company brought me in for leadership training and consultation. The CEO and his executives prepared a state of the company brief that detailed the company's strategic vision in order to improve performance. The brief included multiple sections, each with a number of tasks and projects embedded within. He sat me down and ran through the brief so I could get a feel for what they were doing. It contained a plethora of new initiatives, each with its own set of challenges. First, the CEO planned to launch several lines of new product, each with its own marketing plan. With the aim of expansion, the CEO hoped to establish distribution centers in a dozen new markets in the next 18 to 24 months. Additionally, he planned to break into the laboratory equipment market, which he hoped to sell through their access to doctors and hospitals. The CEO also discussed a new training program designed to educate managers and improve their effectiveness as leaders. Additionally, the company planned a complete website overhaul to update their antiquated site and improve customer experience and branding. Finally, with the aim to improve sales, the CEO also planned to restructure the company's sales force and compensation plan. This entailed an activity management system that could more effectively focus the sales force on income-producing activities and reduce wasted time and effort. The CEO went into great detail through a multitude of very impressive-sounding plans. He was clearly passionate about the company and excited to implement this array of new initiatives to get the company back on track. At the end of the brief, the CEO asked if I had any questions. "Have you ever heard of the military term decisively engaged?" I asked. "No, I haven't. I was never in the military," the CEO replied with a smile. "Decisively engaged," I continued, "is a term used to describe a battle in which a unit locked in a tough combat situation cannot maneuver or extricate themselves. In other words, they cannot retreat. They must win. With all your new initiatives, I would say you have a hell of a lot of battles going on," I observed. "Absolutely. We are spread pretty thin," the CEO acknowledged, wondering where this was going. "Of all the initiatives, which one do you feel is the most important?" I asked. "Which one is your highest priority?" "That's easy," the CEO quickly answered. "The activity management of our sales force is the highest priority. We have to make sure our salespeople are engaged in the right activities. If they aren't getting in front of customers and selling our products, we will no longer be in business," said the CEO. "With all that you have planned, do you think your team is clear that this is your highest priority?" I asked. "Probably not," the CEO admitted. "On the battlefield, if the guys on the front line face to face with the enemy aren't doing their jobs, nothing else matters. Defeat is inevitable," I replied. "With all your other efforts, all your other focuses, how much actual attention is being given to ensuring your frontline salespeople are doing the best job possible? How much of a difference would it make if you and the entire company gave them 100% of your attention for the next few weeks or months?" "It would probably make a huge difference," the CEO admitted. "As a SEAL, I often saw this with junior leaders on the battlefield," I continued. "With so much going on, in the chaos and mayhem, they would try and take on too many tasks at once. It never worked. I taught them to prioritize and execute. Prioritize your problems and take care of them one at a time, the highest priority first. Don't try and do everything at once, or you won't be successful. I explained how a leader who tries to take on too many problems simultaneously will likely fail at them all." "What about our other initiatives?" the CEO asked. "They will help us as well." "I'm not saying to throw them away," I replied. "They sound like great initiatives that are definitely important. But you won't move the needle on them when you are spread so thin. My suggestion is to focus on one, and when that one is completed, or at least has some real momentum, then you move on to the next one and focus on it. When that one is done, then move on to the next, and so on down the line until you have knocked them all out." "Makes sense," the CEO replied. "I'll give it a try." He was eager to turn the company's performance around. For the next several months, the CEO focused the efforts of the entire company on supporting the frontline sales force, making it clear that this was the company's highest priority. The lab set up tours for customers. The marketing designers helped create new, informative pamphlets for products. Sales managers set minimum marks for the number of introductory meetings with doctors and medical administrators that the sales force had to achieve each week. The company's marketing team created online videos interviewing their top salespeople on the most successful techniques so that others could watch and learn. It was a full focus of effort on the highest priority initiative to increase the company's business. This focus on a singular initiative unified the efforts of the entire company. Progress was seen quickly and gained momentum. The CEO recognized the traction and the effectiveness of the method. Prioritize and execute. Chapter 8. Decentralized Command. Jocko Willink. South Central Ramadi, Iraq. A reckoning. "We've got armed enemy fighters on top of a building. Appear to be snipers," the radio blared. The concern and excitement in the American soldier's voice relaying the information was evident. This report was alarming and immediately struck a chord with everyone on the radio net. Enemy snipers were deadly. While they could never compare to the level of skill, training, and equipment that our own U.S. military snipers possessed, the enemy certainly had some skilled marksmen who inflicted substantial damage, regularly killing or wounding American and Iraqi soldiers with accurate rifle shots. Two different elements of our task unit Bruiser SEALs were out there in enemy territory among a hostile insurgent force with friendly U.S. Army troops moving into the area. My job was command and control of 30-plus SEALs and their partner force of Iraqi soldiers, but I could only manage this effectively through decentralized command. It was the only way to operate. On the battlefield, I expected my subordinate leaders to do just that: lead. I had groomed and trained them. Leif and his fellow SEAL officers, their platoon chiefs, and senior petty officers, to make decisions. I trusted that their assessment of the situations they were in and their decisions would be aggressive in pursuit of mission accomplishment, well thought out, tactically sound, and would ultimately further our strategic mission. They confirmed that trust over and over again throughout our months in Ramadi. Leif and my other leaders were put in some of the worst situations imaginable. Enemy fire, confusion and chaos, friendly fire, and worst of all, the pain and emotion of our brother SEALs wounded or killed. In each of those situations, they led with authority and courage, making rapid, sequential, life-and-death decisions in harrowing situations with limited information. I trusted them. They had earned that trust through many months of training, of getting it wrong and learning from their mistakes as I watched them closely and coached them in the leadership principles I had learned through 15 years in the SEAL teams. Both of my platoon commanders were relatively new to the teams, but luckily, they were both eager to learn, eager to lead, and most important, humble yet confident to command. But once we were in Ramadi, I could no longer be with them to look over their shoulders and guide them. I had to empower them to lead. After seeing them evolve during our training cycle into bold, confident leaders, I knew that Leif and Charlie Platoon and his fellow platoon commander in Delta Platoon would make the right decisions. And I knew they would ensure that their subordinate leaders within each of their platoons would make the right decisions. I unleashed them on the battlefield to execute with full confidence in their leadership. Pushing the decision-making down to the subordinate frontline leaders within the task unit was critical to our success. This decentralized command structure allowed me, as the commander, to maintain focus on the bigger picture, coordinate friendly assets, and monitor enemy activity. Were I to get embroiled in the details of a tactical problem, there would be no one else to fill my role and manage the strategic mission. The proper understanding and utilization of decentralized command takes time and effort to perfect. For any leader, placing full faith and trust in junior leaders with less experience and allowing them to manage their teams is a difficult thing to embrace. It requires tremendous trust and confidence in those frontline leaders, who must very clearly understand the strategic mission and ensure that their immediate tactical decisions ultimately contribute to accomplishing the overarching goals. Frontline leaders must also have trust and confidence in their senior leaders to know that they are empowered to make decisions and that their senior leaders will back them up. This skill of decentralized command had not been magically bestowed upon Task Unit Bruiser. It had come only through difficult preparation and training, driven home during the months of effort before we deployed to Iraq. We learned our greatest lessons in this during MOUNT, Military Operations Urban Terrain Training, at Fort Knox, Kentucky. There, under intense pressure and extremely challenging scenarios, we learned how to employ this tenet effectively in the most chaotic scenarios. The MOUNT facility was a multi-block mock city of concrete structures ranging from simulated one-room houses to large, complex, multi-story buildings built to prepare units for the challenges of urban combat, exactly the environment in which U.S. forces were then heavily engaged in Iraq. The SEAL Training Detachment, or TRADET, which I would later command, was tasked with preparing SEAL platoons and task units for deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan, and we knew they would put us through the ringer. The TRADET instructor cadre constructed training scenarios to confuse, disorient, physically and mentally stress, and overwhelm the participating SEAL units, particularly the leaders. The instructor cadre would mudsuck us at every turn, a SEAL term for a cheap shot or a sucker punch. Their role players, acting as enemy forces in training scenarios, often wouldn't follow the rules of play. Some SEALs scoffed at this, thinking the training was unrealistically challenging, and accused TRADET of cheating. I disagreed. The enemy we would face in Iraq had no rules. They didn't care about collateral damage. They didn't care about fratricide or friendly fire. Iraqi insurgents were experts at analyzing and exploiting our weaknesses. They were brutal savages, and their method of operation was to think of the most horrific, cowardly, and effective ways to kill us. So we actually needed TRADET to do the same thing to us. During the first few days of Task Unit Bruiser's MOUNT training, my SEAL leaders tried to control everything and everyone themselves. They tried to direct every maneuver, control every position, and personally attempted to manage each one of their men, up to 35 individuals in Task Unit Bruiser. It did not work. In a striking realization that military units throughout history have come to understand by experience, it became clear that no person had the cognitive capacity, the physical presence, or the knowledge of everything happening across a complex battlefield to effectively lead in such a manner. Instead, my leaders learned that they must rely on their subordinate leaders to take charge of their smaller teams within the team and allow them to execute based on a good understanding of the broader mission, known as commander's intent, and standard operating procedures. That was effective decentralized command. So, we divided into small teams of 4 to 6 SEALs, a manageable size for a leader to control. Each platoon commander didn't worry about controlling all 16 SEAL operators assigned. Only 3, his squad leaders and his platoon chief. Each platoon chief and leading petty officer only had to control their fire team leaders, who each controlled 4 SEAL shooters. And I only had to control 2 people, my 2 platoon commanders. Each leader was trusted to lead and guide his team in support of the overall mission. Those junior leaders learned that they were expected to make decisions. They couldn't ask, "What do I do?" Instead, they had to state, "This is what I am going to do." Since I made sure everyone understood the overall intent of the mission, every leader worked and led separately, but in a unified way that contributed to the overall mission, making even the most chaotic scenarios much easier to handle. When Task Unit Bruiser deployed to Ramadi, Iraq, decentralized command played a crucial role in our success. We supported many large-scale operations and participated in virtually every big push into Ramadi as coalition forces established footholds in enemy territory. A few months into our deployment, we conducted our largest operation yet. It included 2 different U.S. Army battalions, each with hundreds of soldiers, a U.S. Marine battalion, nearly 100 armored vehicles on the ground, and American aircraft in the skies overhead. Many of these units operated on different communications networks, which greatly added to the complexity and compounded the risk. Our SEAL sniper teams would lead the way into the area of operations. By occupying the high ground with the best visibility over the battlefield, Task Unit Bruiser SEALs would gain substantial tactical advantage over the enemy and protect other U.S. forces on the ground. But all this movement could create chaos. My job was to provide command and control to coordinate between my SEAL sniper overwatch teams from Charlie and Delta Platoon and the U.S. Army and Marine Corps units. This operation centered around a major north-south road that was sandwiched between two notoriously violent neighborhoods: the Malab District, a war-torn neighborhood to the east, and to the west, J Block, an American designation for an equally violent section of central Ramadi. In the Malab, Task Unit Bruiser suffered our first casualty during the initial weeks of our deployment. A young SEAL operator sustained a gunshot wound from an enemy armor-piercing machine gun round, which shattered his femur and ripped a massive hole in his leg. SEAL machine gunner Mike Mansour laid down suppressive fire and helped drag him out of the street to safety. Luckily, the wounded SEAL survived and returned to the States for a long road to recovery. The SEALs in Corregidor were in firefights on an almost daily basis in the Malab. Leif and the SEALs of Charlie Platoon had been likewise heavily engaged in constant gun battles with enemy fighters. In the J Block, only a couple of weeks prior, Ryan Job was shot in the face by an enemy sniper and left blind. Later, on the same day Ryan was wounded, Mark Lee was shot and killed just down the street in the J Block from where Ryan had been wounded. Mark was the first member of Task Unit Bruiser killed in action, and the first Navy SEAL killed in Iraq. We were still reeling from those losses suffered during what was one of the most furious battles that had taken place in Ramadi. Leif had also been wounded, hit in the back with a round during the battle. Although injured, it had not stopped him from continuing to lead during that operation, nor had it dulled his desire to hunt down the enemy and kill them. It was no coincidence that our largest operation would take place in this area. It was a reckoning. The operation began as our SEALs, under cover of darkness, patrolled on foot into position. Charlie Platoon from Cop Falcon to the west, and Delta Platoon from Cop Eagle's Nest to the east. They passed their positions over the radio periodically so that I, staged with our Army counterparts at Cop Falcon and other friendly forces, could track their movement. Both Charlie and Delta platoons had pre-selected locations for their sniper overwatch positions based on careful map studies of the area. With the greater strategic picture to coordinate, I had left this entirely up to them. They also had full authority to shift locations if those pre-selected positions weren't adequate once they were on the ground. As they had been trained, the senior leader of each SEAL sniper overwatch element made their decisions based on the underlying commander's guidance that drove our overwatch operations. 1. Cover as many enemy ingress and egress routes as possible. 2. Set up positions that mutually support each other. 3. Pick solid fighting positions that could be defended against heavy enemy attack for an extended period of time if necessary. With their lives and the lives of their men at risk, my platoon commanders understood this guidance as well, perhaps even better than I. Therefore, I did not need to spell it out for each operation. It was embedded in their thoughts. With it, my frontline leaders were empowered to make the tactical decisions during the operation. They were the ones who were on the scene to make the call while I was located over a kilometer away at Cop Falcon, tracking the mission alongside U.S. Army commanders. Sometimes, despite detailed map studies and planning, my frontline leaders discovered that their pre-planned locations were not viable. On numerous occasions, our overwatch elements arrived at a building they had planned to utilize, only to realize that the building was set farther back from the road than it appeared on the map, or did not have optimal angles to cover enemy routes and protect friendly positions. Other times, the building was surrounded by dead space, areas that would be difficult to see and difficult to defend. Then it was up to the platoon leadership to select another building that could best accomplish the mission. Here, decentralized command was a necessity. In such situations, the leaders did not call and ask me what they should do. Instead, they told me what they were going to do. I trusted them to make adjustments and adapt the plan to unforeseen circumstances while staying within the parameters of the guidance I had given them and our standard operating procedures. I trusted them to lead. My ego took no offense to my subordinate leaders on the front lines calling the shots. In fact, I was proud to follow their lead and support them. With my leaders running their teams and handling the tactical decisions, it made my job much easier by enabling me to focus on the bigger picture. On this particular operation, Charlie Platoon's pre-planned position worked well. But Delta Platoon realized that they could not utilize the building that they had planned to use. Delta's platoon commander and his senior platoon leadership scouted out another building that could work. The commander radioed and told me his platoon would move across the street to the other building, Building 94. I responded to him over the radio. "This is Jocko. I copy. You want to move to Building 94. Do it." Delta Platoon then immediately pushed this information to the rest of the friendly forces, including the U.S. Army Battalion staff and company leadership with which I was co-located at Cop Falcon. I sat back and watched as their plan was relayed and ensured the information was clear at higher headquarters. Once all friendly forces had been notified and Delta Platoon confirmed that, they initiated movement to the newly selected building. Building 94 proved to be a very good vantage point. One of the tallest buildings in the area, at 4 stories in height, it had a clear view of the major north-south road and of the location where the Army would soon construct Cop Grant, the new combat outpost. Building 94 was easily defensible and offered good firing positions that covered many potential enemy routes in and out of the area. Once Delta Platoon was in position, their radio man reported, "Building 94 secure. Overwatch position set in the 4th story. And on rooftop." "Copy," I acknowledged. The radio men then relayed that information to other units in the area, and I confirmed that the other units understood the location of Delta's new position. With Charlie and Delta platoons now secured in their positions, American troops flooded into the area. This stage of the mission left U.S. forces highly vulnerable. With no permanent security yet in place, brave Army engineers began building the COP, a construction project in a hostile combat zone. Tensions rose in the streets and among the command and control element I was with back at Cop Falcon. As friendly forces moved in, reports of possible enemy movement came in over the radio nets. Lights came on in buildings, while in others, lights went out. Vehicles started up, departed driveways, and moved through the streets. A military-aged male maneuvered through the alleyways, observing friendly troop movements. A report described a possible enemy force of 2 to 4 military-aged males exiting a building and dispersing. Other men were seen talking on radios. This was the most nerve-wracking time, before the shooting started, waiting with anxious anticipation for a fight to happen. Our SEALs and the hundreds of U.S. troops in this operation had fought fierce battles with the enemy in the bordering neighborhoods for the past several months. Much American blood had been spilled, including the blood of our SEAL brothers. Now, it was only a matter of time before the enemy attacked, which we expected would be ferocious. Then, from a Bradley fighting vehicle equipped with thermal sight for nighttime operations, the report came over the radio. "We've got armed enemy fighters on top of a building. Appear to be snipers." A single enemy bullet had struck Ryan Job, severely wounding him, leaving him blind, and eventually leading to his death. A young Marine from 2nd Anglico, whom we frequently worked with, had been shot and killed by a single rifle shot just a few weeks before. Many others had been wounded or killed by a single round. Just as our snipers struck fear into the hearts of our enemy, an enemy sniper was a nightmare scenario for us. Shooting accurately from unseen positions, inflicting casualties, and fading away. So now this report comes across the net that enemy snipers had been spotted, caused everyone's defenses to spike, and escalated the tensions in their trigger fingers. Charlie and Delta platoons, in their separate overwatch positions, heard the report on their radios and were also amped up by the call. Perhaps one or more of these enemy snipers were the culprits responsible for shooting Ryan and our Marine comrade. Any one of our SEALs would gladly eliminate the enemy snipers with lethal force. But despite the romantic vision of a sniper versus sniper stalking and shooting match, our preferred contest was a much more lopsided affair. Enemy sniper versus the massive firepower of a US M1 A2 Abrams main battle tank. An enemy sniper might barricade himself in a room behind sandbags and concrete. While this made for a difficult rifle shot, it was no match for the tank's electronically enhanced optics and giant 120mm smoothbore cannon fired from behind the safety of heavy armor. We all hoped for a quick engagement by the Bradley that had spotted the enemy sniper. Of course, I wanted as much as anyone to see an enemy sniper, or even better, multiple snipers eliminated. But this was a complex battlefield, which could confuse and confound even the most experienced soldiers and SEALs. The fog of war in a chaotic urban environment grows thick rapidly and could muddle even the most seemingly obvious situations. The company commander, a U.S. Army captain in charge of the Bradley fighting vehicle that reported the enemy snipers, was an exceptional warrior and leader whom our SEALs had come to deeply respect and admire. He and his soldiers were an outstanding group. We had formed a tremendous bond with them through dozens of operations working together. Our SEAL snipers supported their operations, and they in turn responded continuously to our calls for help by rolling out in their tanks down extremely dangerous, uncleared roads to bring firepower to bear and provide evacuation of our SEAL casualties. Every time we called for help, the company commander fearlessly placed himself and his men at great risk. He personally saddled up and drove out in his tank to bring the thunder on our behalf and beat back enemy attacks on SEAL positions. Now, the company commander heard the report of enemy snipers. He responded over the radio, "Give a description of the target." The Bradley's vehicle commander answered, "Several military-aged males on a rooftop. They appear to have some heavy weapons, and some have what appear to be sniper weapons with scopes." Monitoring the radio calls, I stood next to the company commander in the makeshift talk inside Cop Falcon. Knowing I had SEAL snipers on the rooftop near where the enemy was spotted, I quickly asked, "Find out what building number they see the enemy in." The company commander radioed his Bradley commander for an exact position. "Building 7-9, replied the Bradley vehicle commander. "Your guys aren't in building 7-9, are they?" the company commander asked me, just to be sure. I looked at my battle map to coordinate the numbers I was hearing over the net. I located building 7-9, just down the street from where Delta Platoon was located, in building 9-4. "Negative," I replied to the captain. "I've got SEALs in building 9-4. Not in 7-9. "All right, let's engage," said the captain, fired up to take out some enemy snipers. Every one of us was eager to hammer enemy fighters and protect the U.S. troops on the ground in harm's way. But we had to be sure. "Stand by," I said. "Let's confirm what we have here." I keyed up my radio to talk to my SEALs on the less formal net that only we utilized. I spoke directly to Delta's platoon commander. "We have some enemy activity in your vicinity. Possible snipers. Want to engage with a Bradley main gun. I need you to confirm your position, 100%. "Roger," he replied. "I have already triple checked. Building direct to our south is 9-1. South of that is the road. The roof of our building has an L-shaped room on the roof. You can see it on the battle map. I'm sitting in it. It is confirmed. We are in building 9-4. 100%. Over." I acknowledged the Delta Platoon commander's transmission. Then, to the company commander next to me, I said, "It's confirmed. My guys are in building 9-4. "All right then, let's hammer these guys," the company commander replied. "Hold on," I said. checking one more time. Let's confirm what your guys are seeing. We have confirmed. Enemy snipers on the rooftop of Building 7-9, responded the company commander. There are no other friendlies in that building. We need to engage while we can. He didn't want to miss a critical chance to take out enemy snipers. I didn't like the idea of delaying an opportunity to eliminate enemy snipers any more than he did. But knowing the confusing chaos of the urban battlefield and how easily mistakes can happen, I had to be certain. Do me a favor, I asked the company commander, just to confirm. Have your Bradley vehicle commander count the number of buildings he sees from the major intersection, where he was positioned, up to the building where he has eyes on the enemy snipers. The company commander looked at me with a little frustration. If these were indeed enemy snipers, they might target U.S. forces at any moment. Allowing them to live even for a few more minutes meant they might very well kill Americans. I just want to be sure, I added. The company commander didn't work for me. I couldn't order him to delay. But through multiple combat operations together with our SEALs in this difficult environment, we had developed a strong professional working relationship. He loved our SEALs and appreciated the damage we inflicted on the enemy. He now trusted me enough to comply with my request. Okay, he said. The company commander keyed up his radio and instructed his Bradley vehicle commander. For final confirmation, count the number of buildings from the intersection where you're located to the building where you see the enemy snipers. The Bradley vehicle commander paused at this, likely wondering why he was being asked to do this while enemy snipers waited to attack. But he did as directed, replying on the radio, "Roger that, stand by." It should have taken no more than 15 seconds to count the buildings up the block to the target building, but the silence over the radio was longer. Too long. Finally, the radio silence broke. "Correction. The suspected enemy position is building 9-4. I say again, 9-4. I counted the buildings up the block. We misjudged the distance. Over." "Hold your fire," the company commander quickly said with authority over his battalion net, recognizing that the enemy reported in building 9-4 were really friendlies. "All stations, hold your fire. Personnel in building 9-4 are friendly. I say again, building 9-4 is a friendly position. We have SEAL snipers on the roof of that building." "Roger," said the Bradley vehicle commander in a solemn tone, recognizing his mistake had almost caused fratricide. "Roger," answered the captain, alarmed at how easily such a mistake could happen and acknowledging how deadly and devastating it could have been. The company commander looked at me and said heavily, "That was a close one." Without formal street signs or numbers, with confusing intersections and alleyways, such a mix-up was something that could easily happen. But had they engaged, it would have been horrific. The 25mm heavy gun from the Bradley fired high explosive rounds that would have ripped through the rooftop, likely killing or wounding multiple SEALs in that position. Thankfully, our troop operated under decentralized command. My platoon commanders didn't just tell me what the situation was, but what they were going to do to fix it. That sort of extreme ownership and leadership from my subordinate leaders not only allowed them to lead confidently, but also allowed me to focus on the bigger picture. In this case, monitoring the actions of coordinating units in this dynamic environment. Had I been engulfed in trying to lead and direct Charlie and Delta Platoon's tactical decisions from my distant position, I may very well have missed the other events unfolding. This could have had catastrophic results. Instead, decentralized command worked and enabled us as a team to effectively manage risk, prevent disaster, and accomplish our mission. Soon, the real enemy fighters struck with violent attacks to protect their territory along the central north-south street. But our enemy's enthusiasm was extinguished quickly when SEAL snipers and machine gunners killed them in the very streets they aimed to defend. Decentralized command enabled us to operate effectively on a challenging battlefield and support our U.S. Army comrades to construct the new combat outpost and ensure more soldiers came home safely. Ultimately, this furthered the strategic mission to stabilize Ramadi and secure the populace, which would prove highly successful over the coming months. Principle. Human beings are generally not capable of managing more than 6 to 10 people, particularly when things go sideways and inevitable contingencies arise. No one senior leader can be expected to manage dozens of individuals, much less hundreds. Teams must be broken down into manageable elements of 4 to 5 operators with a clearly designated leader. These leaders must understand the overall mission and the ultimate goal of that mission, the commander's intent. Junior leaders must be empowered to make decisions on key tasks necessary to accomplish that mission in the most effective and efficient manner possible. Teams within teams are organized for maximum effectiveness for a particular mission, with leaders who have clearly delineated responsibilities. Every tactical level team leader must understand not just what to do, but why they are doing it. If frontline leaders do not understand why, they must ask their boss to clarify why. This ties in closely with Believe, Chapter 3. Decentralized command does not mean junior leaders or team members operate on their own program. That result